Okay. Dear all, it's my pleasure to welcome you on this online webcast from the University of Jyväskylä, Finland, 4th of March 2013. And my name is Raimo Vuorinen. I'm the coordinator of the European Lifelong Guidance Policy Network and sharing this session today with you. And we have a live audience here at the university. It's the school counselor postgraduate diploma course from the university, and with their trainers, Ms. Jaana Saarinen, Ms. Pia Nissilä, and Ulla Nuutinen. Welcome. And this session and webcast is jointly organized by the Jyväskylä University, Finnish Institute for Educational Research, ELGPN, the European Lifelong Guidance Policy Network, and Florida State University. And this is part of the 150 years anniversary a celebration of teacher training in Finland. And the theme today, we are talking about and discussing about variables affecting a readiness to benefit from career interventions. And we have a special guest here, Professor James Sampson from Florida State University. And he works as an Associate Dean for Faculty Development and Administration, College of Education, Florida State University. But his career globally is better known on the use of information communication technology in guidance, design of guidance services, and also evaluating the impact of guidance services. And he is acting as a co-director of the Center for Study of Technology in Counseling and Career Development in Florida State University. And that is a center that has been focusing on this topic for decades already. And Jim is, he has been consulting many countries in the development of their national guidance services, World Bank, European Commission, and he's a great fan of Finland and visiting Finland frequently since 1998, if I remember correct. So approximately, he has been here close to 20 times. So he knows very well the context, and he's also an overseas professor of the university. And one of the key issues is also what we are talking about today is about the readiness in the use of career services. And he has been focusing on efficacy of the services, effectiveness of the services, but also on the equity, on the equal access on the actual services. So it's my really pleasure to welcome Jim from Florida State. You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Raimo. It's a great pleasure to be here today. It's the greatest compliment anyone can get ever have as an academic is to be invited back somewhere. And so this is truly an honor. Some specific thank yous, obviously, to Raimo for inviting me, as well as managing the chat function for this event. Jaana is managing the Twitter feed, helping out with that. But I also want to acknowledge my co-authors up here, MC McLean, Susie Moosh, and Bob Reardon, who wrote the paper that is the basis for this presentation today. This paper will be coming out in the Career Development Quarterly this summer, is where the paper will be presented. But also want to acknowledge the other members of my research team, back at Florida State, Janet Lenz, Gary Peterson, and Deb Osborne, who we all work together as a collaborative team. But to also give a warm welcome to my ELGPN and NISEC colleagues who are listening in, and not the least are the people who went out into the cold today to come and be here today. I thank you for coming very much. I've worked as a practitioner, I've worked as a researcher, I've worked as a consultant, and the foundation of all of those activities is really, and as a teacher as well, but the foundation of all of those is practice. Any time that we stray from practice, from what actually people do to help individuals, that's a problem. We always have to stay grounded in what actually happens in the counseling process, in the helping process, in the ways people use information to help them make more informed and careful career decisions. Well, in my work as a practitioner, which was very important in my early career, not quite as much today, But in my work as a practitioner, I was always struck by the fact that some people really seemed to benefit from what I did, and other people didn't seem to make much progress. So it concerned me. Why did some people really seem to take good advantage of the counseling intervention, the career intervention, and why did some people not seem to benefit? Because I was really doing the same thing. And then it really hit me one day. That was the problem. I was doing the same thing. Some people needed what I was doing, and some other people needed something different. So in my progression as a counselor, what I learned is that I have to do a better job of adjusting my intervention to meet the needs of the individual. Now, people here today are nodding as I say that. Well, that makes perfect sense. But how do you do that? That's the difficult part. How do you conceptualize individuals in terms of their needs and then alter what you do so that what you're doing is helpful for the individual? So our research team at Florida State University came up with this concept of readiness for career decision making. And that's really what I want to talk to you about today, is what are the variables affecting readiness to benefit from career interventions? And that relates to readiness for decision making as well. We did not come up with this concept, really. It's been around for a long time. Donald Super, in his pioneering work dealing with career maturity and later with career adaptability, John Holland and his concepts of vocational identity, John Crumbolt and his work on career beliefs and things. There's a long, rich tradition in our field of dealing with what are the variables that make one intervention effective for one person and one for another. But the Florida State University team, Itmar Gatti, has done some very important work on this as well, on decision-making difficulties. A whole host of people who are referenced in the paper on this. But we certainly have taken this concept of readiness and really wanted to apply it to the delivery of career interventions. We did some initial work on it, but I began to become concerned that there were things that we had missing, that the model was not adequate. And so we went back and we re-examined our own readiness model and have adjusted it some, and that's what I'm really presenting today. The presentation is going to have four parts. There'll be a conceptual background and then looking at specific variables that contribute to readiness for effective use of career interventions. We'll then have a break and a chance to ask some questions, and we'll get some questions from those people at a distance as well as some of the people who are here. We'll then talk a little bit about what are the consequences if we don't pay attention to readiness for decision making, and a little bit of quickly, if we have time, on implications for practice and research. Well, let's first start off with a definition. What are we really talking about? And specifically, we're looking today at readiness for career decision making, and that reflects an individual's state of preparation for engaging in the learning processes necessary to explore and decide amongst various options. So it's what does the individual bring to this process of being helped when they're going to use a career intervention? What do they bring with them at that moment in time that will have an impact on their exploring and deciding amongst various options? We began our work, our original work on this. Our original conceptualization of readiness for career decision making was a two-dimensional model. And essentially, it dealt with the capability of an individual to make an appropriate career choice while also taking into account the complexity of family, social, economic, and organizational variables. And the way that we think about this is capability represents what's inside the person, where complexity represents the factors outside the person. And we'll briefly review what those two dimensions are. We know that different levels of career decision making, different levels of readiness for career decision making, can make an intervention successful for one person and not successful for another. That's what I mentioned when I started about my own experience. So we know that to be the case. But there seems to be a lack of awareness amongst practitioners of the negative consequences of really not attending to this readiness concept, and especially the consequences of what happens to a client when they have low readiness for decision making. How does that influence their use of a career intervention? And also, the practitioners are not fully aware of all the different ways we can measure readiness for decision making. In the journal article that's coming out this summer, there's a link to, as I remember, 44 different readiness assessment measures that are currently available that measure the readiness concept. Some of the most interesting and innovative work on readiness for career decision making has been done here in Finland by Jukka Lurkinen, who's with us today. And his measure, his approach has been to develop contextualized measures. You can either have a general measure or a measure that's contextualized for a particular type of client group: high school students, adults who are unemployed, who are seeking employment, adults who are in education making a transition to employment or further education. So his work is really quite remarkable in that regard. But you'll be able to identify some of these other readiness measures from the article that we have. There are basically two approaches that you can take to this in doing a career intervention. You can either try something and see if it works, and if it doesn't work, then adjust, which has been a typical model that we've had, or you can actually take the time at the beginning to assess what the person's needs are and from the beginning adjust your model. That's a more proactive model. The reactive model of try something, see if it works, and then adjust if necessary has been a bit more traditional model. And what we're advocating is a more proactive model where we really understand the client before we begin delivering services. Some of the gaps in the prior research is that most of the research on readiness is really focused on psychological variables and social barriers, really have been most of the work in terms of readiness. But there are other things that we haven't included in readiness very much, and that I think we need to broaden our concept of readiness to include other things, things like literacy, learning disability, prior experience with career services, I think affects a person's readiness to benefit from a career intervention. So we're looking, readiness to benefit from a career intervention is slightly broader than readiness for career decision making, because that's where we take into account things like prior experience with a career intervention, because these are also very, very important variables. So what I have is a schema, a four-part schema for trying to organize these variables. And that would include personal characteristics, personal circumstances, the knowledge, having limited knowledge of self, options, and decision-making, as well as prior experience with career interventions. Those are the four things that we're going to deal with. So let's start with personal characteristics. Well, we can go back to this is our prior model in the cognitive information processing approach, which we've developed at Florida State University. And this is looking at the capability dimension. Remember, capability is what's inside the person. Complexity is what's outside the person. So now let's look inside the person and see what's going on. And there are five things to mention here. One is acute and or chronic negative thoughts and feelings. Acute meaning you haven't had these feelings before, but you know, you've just lost your job, and there's an acute sense of anxiety and depression that you have at that moment that's making it difficult for you to process information and make a informed and careful choice. Or it could be chronic negative thoughts and feelings. We have adjustment to disability, and that adjustment to disability can be physical, emotional, all types of disability, verbal aptitude, limited verbal aptitude, language proficiency, and computer literacy. I have to say that if I were writing this paper today, I would change that term computer literacy. Tristram Hooley from the University of Derby, I think, has a better way of conceptualizing that, and I think Jana as well has done a good job of rethinking in a broader sense this concept. And I think a better term than computer literacy now would be digital literacy, which Tristram really encompasses a person's interaction with the web in ways beyond just what we would traditionally think as computer literacy. So acute and chronic negative thoughts and feelings make it difficult for clients to initiate, to begin the decision-making process, or sustain it once they've begun that process. And there's lots of things that contribute to that. Some people have absolute black and white thinking. It's either going to work or it's going to fail, and they see no shades of gray. They have extreme fear of failure, and that fear of failure influences their behavior. Or alternatively, a fear of success can be just as damaging as fear of failure with that. People who are very perfectionistic in their decision-making styles have high levels of anxiety or depression. And anxiety and depression are two most common mental health issues that we deal with worldwide. So all of these factors can make it difficult for a person to think clearly, to be able to find information, use information, reflect upon that information that they have about themselves and their options, and then the motivation to move forward and take action upon that is affected by all six of these variables that we have here. Adjustment to disability is also an important issue. An individual has an automobile accident, and they've gone through physical therapy, but they have a physical disability now in relationship to that. How will that affect their employment? I know we have a responsibility as employers to adapt to the needs of that individual to make them successful in the workplace. But it's still difficult when you have a major disability to then come back to work and to be able to succeed. There are some significant challenges there. But all types of disabilities, behavioral, emotional, cognitive, physical, or sensory disability. If you are blind or if you are deaf, there are unique issues that you bring to the workplace, that you bring to making a career choice as a result of that. And so we need to take that into account in terms of helping an individual. I think disability is a very important multicultural issue. I think there are specific cultural nuances of people with various disabilities that we need to add to our thinking of multicultural issues. Limited verbal aptitude can make it very difficult for people to make a career choice. And there's some good research on this. And it has to deal with how much information people can process at one time, how many variables they can consider, the kind of verbal tools that they have to process information, how they can deal with symbolic language, the amount of background knowledge that they bring to a particular decision that they're making. People with lower verbal aptitude have somewhat fewer tools to bring to the process. So when we give them very complex information, are they really, really fully able to be able to utilize that information without assistance, would be the question. Language proficiency. One of the things that's happening in Finland as well as really worldwide is there's significant migration between countries. So the number of non-native language speakers in our countries are really increasing. It certainly has been true in the United States for a long time. It's a significant issue here in Finland now, with you have larger numbers of people speaking other languages. Well, when you're working in a different language, it's more challenging. As you go through the mental gymnastics of translating from your language, you read something in another language, translate it into your language, think about it, and then translate it back into the language where you, with the person that you're speaking with. That's the mental effort required to do those sorts of translations can be very taxing on an individual. And those individuals, I think, need sometimes more support. Again, computer literacy, and again, I would refer you to Tristram Hooley's work on digital literacy is really a better one. And he talks about the kind of skills it takes to really navigate the web, understand how to obtain, how to find information, how to be able to use all of the resources that are available to this. It's a mistake to think about that only young people are good at using computers, because we know that across a whole wide range of ages, as socioeconomic classes, that we have people who are successful computer users across all of those groups. But there are some challenges related to that in terms of the amount of time people access information, their time they spend on the internet, and so forth. And there may be some issues regarding age and socioeconomic status that influence that, but we shouldn't make assumptions that just because someone comes from an impoverished background, they have no computer skills. But certainly people who come from impoverished backgrounds have less access to technology in some cases and less chance to practice being good users of technology. The second category, so the first category relates to the capability dimension. It's what's inside the person. It's the characteristics they bring to making a career choice and coming to us for assistance with a career intervention. But the second category is analogous to our capability dimension, to our complexity dimension, which is what are the things outside an individual that influences this. I think in the United States, Jane Swanson has done a lot of work in this particular area. Nancy Betts certainly has, trying to tease out what are these contextual variables and so forth that have influenced people's ability to make choices. The way we talk about them, or we base it on these four variables: family, social, economic, or organizational variables. Your family can either make your career choice easier or more difficult. And having multiple family responsibilities, typically women balancing multiple roles who find that challenging. Multiple family stressors, especially when there's conflict within a family. In the most extreme cases, abusive relationships. It's hard for a woman in an abusive relationship to have more difficult to develop a positive sense of self-efficacy about their abilities to work and their abilities to make a career choice when they're regularly abused at home. That's just, it creates an unbelievable challenge in terms of being able to do that, that we need to attend to. Deferral, again, it's mostly an issue for women who defer aspects of their career development or a stage of their career development for a period of time to raise children, and then entering back into a workforce after a significant period of time can make things challenging. Role overload, again, you know, trying to balance multiple roles in life. And some family input is not very helpful. We do need to be respective of cultural differences, because across cultures, in some cultures, the influence of the family is crucial in making a good choice. And there's a strong need to take into account family influences. However, we should never assume that all family input is good, because there are some circumstances where family input is destructive to an individual, like when a young person is told, you're never going to succeed, you're always going to fail, you know, you're nothing, you know, you're a disgrace to our family. If you're told that over and over and over and over again, it's a bit difficult to develop a sense of positive career self-efficacy with that. So we shouldn't assume that all family input is necessarily good input. But in some cases, families can be very supportive. My family was extremely supportive to me. Whatever I wanted to do was fine. There were no problems. I should make the choice myself. They provided me with support and resources. I couldn't have asked for a better family in growing up in my own circumstance. And that's true for many of us in this room as well. We had good family support. So families can detract or they can really support an individual. Social variables. We know there's quite a bit of social influence. Things like stereotyping, where I know something about you because of the nature of the work that you do. Discrimination is where I act on those negative stereotypes and make decisions about you in inappropriate ways. Some people have a lack of role models in growing up. We have bias in education and employment that still exists. I think we've made progress in my career in that area, but it would be a mistake to assume that issue is resolved and we don't have that anymore. I wish that was the case. I'm afraid that's not true. Some people face a lot of harassment still on the job. We had an interesting discussion at dinner the other night here in Finland about women firefighters. And, you know, how many women firefighters are there in Finland? And what are the issues that women firefighters have upon telling their friends, I'm going to work as a firefighter? What kind of issues do they face going through training? What kind of reinforcement do they get? Because most firefighters in Finland are men. We have to really consider these social variables and how these may really affect a person's decision. There are economic variables as well. We've seen a terrible worldwide recession over the past few years. And that has wreaked havoc in terms of many people's career decision making. Things that they were thinking of doing now that they can no longer do. Certainly whole industries that have had extreme problems and large-scale unemployment. Large-scale youth unemployment is a serious problem that the European Union certainly has recognized and is spending enormous resources to try to deal with that particular group. The NEET group, the not engaged in employment and training, which has been a strong focus in the UK, we would include that those economic variables here. So there's the general economic impact, but there's also a personal economic impact. There are many people who would love to get additional education and training, but in countries where education and training is not readily supported by the government, if they don't have adequate financial resources, that education and training is not available to them. Poverty has probably one of the strongest negative impacts of any of the variables that we can look at from an economic sense. Poverty affects so many elements of an individual's life where they will really need to deal with that. David Bluestein in the United States has written extensively and very thoughtfully on that particular topic. Organizational variables. This is only for people who are working, but some organizations support career development and others don't. Some organizations have a complicated internal job market. Some organizations are in a state of flux. And there are some organizations that have a very, very unsupportive organizational culture. One that I can remember, HR manager said, I regularly use social media to find out who's looking for a job, and I immediately fire them because I want total loyalty to our company. Another HR manager at the same meeting stood up and said, you're a fool. I do the same thing. I check to see who's looking for a job. I go to them and I say, what do we need to do to keep you here? What do we need to do to make this the kind of place that you really want to work? So organizational culture can really support or inhibit a person's career choices. And we need to examine those variables as people come to us. The third in our categories of variables has to deal with the fact that some people have limited knowledge of important aspects of the career decision-making process. And that's knowledge of self, the options they have, and decision-making. And it comes from these four things we mentioned here: limited life experience, limited inclination to reflect on self-knowledge, limited knowledge of options, and limited knowledge about decision-making in and of itself. And these major categorical areas come from our cognitive information processing model for career choice. So some individuals have very little life experience. I was talking with a young man, a college student, and I asked him, you know, what are some of the things that you've done in your life? You know, what kind of work experiences have you had? What volunteer work, what paid work? And he said, well, I don't have any. I said, well, how did you spend your time when you were in secondary school, in high school? He said, well, I play video games. I said, anything else? He said, no, that's basically what I did. So he's never interacted with a supervisor, never been challenged, never had any training. Simply went to school, went to class, came home and played video games. Well, we give them an assessment of interests, interest inventory, and we wonder why they have difficulty answering the items. He doesn't know what he likes and dislikes. He has nothing to bounce it off against. So some people that have extraordinarily limited life experiences have difficulty in articulating what their values, interests, and skills and employment preferences may be, because they haven't had any option to experience life to know what they like and what they don't like. For some young people, when they say, I don't really know, that's really the truth. They don't really know because they haven't had enough life experience. John Krumholz talks about these individuals and says that the best intervention for some individuals like this is a systematic program for living, for exploring, for trying things, and then making a better and more informed decision. Limited inclination to reflect on self-knowledge gained from life experience. There are some people who just are not very reflective people. They go through life sort of experiencing it and just living. But their time they spend reflecting on that experience, thinking about, well, was this good or was this bad? Was this helpful? Did I like this? Why? They don't do it. They're simply like a pinball in a pinball machine. They just kind of bounce through life, reacting, you know, to various things, but they don't really reflect much with that. And these individuals, I think, have a lot more difficult time using a career intervention. For example, if we ask a person like this to build a portfolio, an adult who's underemployed, who we're trying to help, and we say, you need to build a portfolio of your experiences, and let's look at your transferable skills. What transferable skills? I just worked. No, but there are certain fundamental skills that you have developed. Well, I don't know what you're talking about. In other words, they simply don't have that ability to connect back their experiences with what that means. In some of our narrative approaches to counseling today, we talk about making meaning and construction of knowledge. They have a difficult time in that reflective process of creating some meaning from the life experiences that they've had. Many people have very little knowledge of occupation. If you ask the average college student in the United States, name as many occupations as you can think of, they typically will come up with under 20. You know, engineer, firefighter, physician, artist, journalist. In other words, most people simply don't have a large store of occupational information. And they have a difficult time in responding to the question of, well, what would you like to do? It's like a deer in headlights. Or in the case of northern Finland, it would be a reindeer in the headlights. They don't know. They can't answer that question of what aspirations they have. They have a very difficult time making the connection between themselves and options that they would really enjoy. So they have a very difficult time providing you with a list of options. And some individuals have little experience with decision making. Now, this relates to those family variables that we talked about before. Because if you have a family where you have an over-functioning parent who says, I love you so much, I'm going to help you, and it's the parent who's over-involved in their child's life, the parent who doesn't allow the child to fail, the parent who doesn't give the child choices, oh, I know what's best for you, honey. Let me make this decision for you. You know, I'm mother or father, whatever, knows best. And so as a result of that, the person grows up being helped so much, they then have no decision-making skills on their own. The only decision they have is, you know, which flavor juice do I have? You know, if they even get that. But they have never really gone through making a decision that had consequences where they might fail. It's really only by failing that we succeed. And some children are denied that by an overfunctioning parent. And there's a whole host of, in our literature on family systems and so forth, there's a whole host of variables that influence why a parent would do that to a child. But where we see it as an issue is when the child has to make a career decision. And we ask, I'll say, a typical question I ask in counseling is, tell me about an important decision that you've made recently. One that involved a lot of money or one that involved some consequences. And tell me how you went about that decision. And there is none. Most of those decisions have been made for them by someone else. Well, now we say, and now you're going to make this very high-stakes decision related to your career. They have no experience to do so. I think that's another variable to look at. The fourth category of variables that we're looking at here has to deal with prior experience with career interventions themselves. And this category contributes to low readiness for effective use of cure interventions. And it looks at specifically their prior experience in using counseling websites, career courses, computer-based guidance systems, or other career tools. And one is limited prior experience with career resources. In other words, they've never really used the internet to find career information. They've never taken many career tests, interest inventories, and so forth. So they've had limited prior exposure to career assessments or career information. And so they have no context or no schema for how to use them. They've never seen them before. And they find it particularly difficult to do this. Another one is inappropriate expectations. People come to counseling or come to the career decision looking for the one perfect answer. I'm just searching for that one thing that's going to be the true thing for me and my life. Well, Donald Super said many, many years ago that there's actually multiple occupations that are available to satisfy your interests. I think Holland and Krumholtz have said very, very similar sorts of things. But this unrealistic belief that there is one perfect choice and all the client has to do is work hard to find that creates an expectation that doesn't really match reality with this and complicates this. And when we look at the negative consequences of a low readiness, you'll see an example of this. We'll do that after our break. Negative prior experience with career interventions. This is the most common that I've run into. Oh, yeah, I took that test when I was in secondary school. It said I should have been a funeral director. Oh, how stupid, you know. But actually, I use funeral director in a very positive way, and I'll say, do you like working independently? Would you like owning your own business? Would you really like working with people? Yes, I like all those things. What you've just described is the work of a funeral director. Not a person who's an embalmer. Embalmer works with people who are dead. A funeral director works with people who are living. And so you end up with people saying, oh, I took that test. What a waste of time. Or I had a counselor. In the United States, they'll say, oh, yeah, I had a counselor in high school. Yeah, there was one counselor for all 800 of us students. I saw him in the hall twice. That was career guidance for me. What a waste of my time, you know. Or we all went into the auditorium and they talked to us for an hour about making a career choice. I fell asleep. And so that's their prior experience with career interventions. They come to the process of being helped with some real negative expectations. And especially, they create a self-fulfilling prophecy that not only was that a bad experience, but my talking with you was going to be a waste of my time. I'll sit politely. I'll nod at the appropriate times. I'm thinking about what I'm going to have for lunch. And that's their use of our career intervention, which really is essentially a waste of time. The next thing I want to talk about is some consequences of not attending to readiness. But the way we've designed today is to take a pause, since we've really looked at all the variables that negatively impact a person's ability to benefit from using a career intervention, their readiness for using a career intervention. We want to stop, give you a chance to ask questions, either some things perhaps I've missed in this from your experience is important, or things that you think should be emphasized or not emphasized, or things I haven't been clear about, which is entirely possible. And we've also been watching the interaction of other folks at a distance who are watching this presentation. And Raimo and Jana have some questions they may want to add to this as well. So why don't we have Raimo kind of manage this particular part of the presentation.
Okay. I think it might be helpful that if you turn to your neighbor for 1 or 2 minutes and reflect together, and after that we might get more questions to Jim. And those who are watching this live, I have some participants here within the Connect Pro, but on a Twitter we have a hashtag CIPJKL as the address, so I give also opportunity for our international participants to join the discussion. But two minutes. One question from Spain, Luis Prado. If we start with that one, and I've noticed that we are getting questions from Iceland and UK. They are typing at the moment, the colleagues over there. But Luis Prado from the University of Santiago de Compostela, Spain, he's asking, at what extent social cultural factors, for example, people in immigration, are a variable in the decision-making of a career choice?
I think that's an excellent question, because immigration is certainly a huge issue for us to deal with, both legal and illegal immigration factors influence employment and decision-making and so forth. What's really amazing about immigration is it brings a whole host of variables with it, because you have the language issue. Just because a person is an immigrant doesn't necessarily mean their language skills are in any way a problem, because there can be people who have extremely well-developed language skills. In Europe in particular, there's been an emphasis in education on developing language skills, and the mobility among countries has been an important part of European Union policy for many years, and structures to be able to facilitate that. So that's an example of where we really need to look at the readiness of an individual, a person that has grown up with multiple languages, with the expectation that they were going to be living in other cultures. As part of their education growing up, they've had experiences several times as a young person and a young adult living in other cultures is entirely different from a person who, because of a war or famine, has left one country in an acute crisis, moved to another country, and is now trying to cope with being pulled out of their culture, placed in another, in some cases involuntarily. That's an entirely different circumstance. So we need to look at immigration in terms of not a unidimensional construct, I think, or a series of issues that people may have, but looking at that individually. What is the language skills the person has? Again, you know, verbal aptitude comes into play. What kind of family dynamics? When a person comes from a culture where the family is incredibly involved in the career decision making of the individual, when I spent some time in Eastern Turkey, certainly that was a very, very important aspect of the decision making process. Then to come to a Western nation where there's much more of an influence on individuality, and the guidance system reflects that, how do we accommodate input from the family? And the fact that a person comes to us saying, I need to talk with my parents about that, that's not necessarily low readiness. It's a culturally appropriate factor for them. But how do we serve that person within our culture and the way that we deliver services if they come to us as an immigrant? So immigration actually is an excellent window into the complexity of the kind of circumstances, personal characteristics and circumstances that people bring. I hope that adequately touches on that question.
Okay, any questions from the audience? Sakari has a roaming microphone which we can use. Any immediate reflections? You can address them in Finnish as well. No problem.
Thank you. Thank you. I was wondering about development of counseling theories mm-hmm. since Parsons. If you think about Parsons and counseling theories now, what is the main difference? How theories have developed?
Well, that's a good question. Certainly there's been a lot of evolution of theories since Parsons. Our own work in cognitive information processing really kind of starts with Parsons and evolves from that. All of the theories have had some attention to readiness. If you look at Donald Super's theory, for example, his early work on career maturity, because his initial research was with young people, but as he himself grew older, he became more concerned with career decision-making of adults, and then he adapted his theory to include career adaptability, which is sort of the career maturity concept for adults. And recently, Mark Savickas has done a lot of writing on the career adaptability concept as well. So we've seen theories evolve over time. I think there's been a lot of emphasis recently on constructivist approaches in career decision making, and especially in narrative approaches to the whole process of helping people make decisions. And one of the things that clearly is emphasized from that theoretical perspective is the importance of understanding the individual's perception themselves. In other words, what sense do they make of the factors that have influenced their own career decision making? So from the readiness standpoint that we've been talking about here, it would be in suggesting that people who take a narrative constructivist theoretical approach to decision making, that in the process of helping them tell their story and constructing their narrative, co-constructing the narrative with them, to pay attention to those forces both within the person and outside the person that really have influenced their choices. Another important theory, Brown-Lent and Hackett, the social cognitive career theory, has looked a lot at what are the social individual influences on individuals and how they develop a sense of career self-efficacy. And I think the readiness variables that we talked about today strongly influence the development of that sense of self-efficacy. So there's a lot of interesting things that are happening really in career theory. I think that we could take each of the career theories that we're teaching in classes, for example, for those of you here, the ones that you're learning about, we can take a look at how the readiness variables influence the variables in those individual theories. Here at the University of Vascula, you've had a strong preparation in the area of multiculturalism. And it's interesting for you to be able to take that second class of variables that we've been looking at, the contextual part. Remember the family, society, the economy, and organizations, and being able to look at the approach that you've been learning here in Uvascula, and thinking through what are the readiness assessment variables that are associated with that.
I have two questions here. Gudbjörg Vilhelmsdottir from University of Reykjavik in Iceland, University of Iceland in Reykjavik, is asking that: how would you address hindrances to readiness that have to do with the social variables, such as being discriminating against because of your gender, for example, police women being harassed in your workplace, or social variables like youth unemployment? And also Wendy Hurst from Sussex is asking that, might these variables help with readiness, not for just career guidance, but for ability to manage one's own career more generally?
Yes, two important things to look at. Let me see if I can take each of those in turn. There's a very important social justice issue here, and that is, to what extent do we as counselors help our clients cope with a system that's not necessarily fair? And to what extent do we have a responsibility to, as Nancy Arthur talks about, as counselors, to actually make changes in the larger social system that, to deal with issues that I think Guga is mentioning from Iceland? And I think our responsibility is really twofold in that. And that really is to balance our efforts to help individuals with strategies for how to cope with some of these negative social variables, the contextual variables, things like discrimination and stereotyping, harassment on the job. I think part of it is helping individuals develop strategies for how to cope. And we do that by looking at how have other people learned to cope with these issues in the workplace, as well as doing what we can through policy and legislation to try to make some systemic change to some of these issues that are causing these problems to begin with. I think some of our social policy and educational policy and employment policy, we've made some progress towards dealing with some of these issues. We still have a ways to go for sure. So it's balancing individual advocacy with more general social advocacy for those issues that are involved. And it's kind of a balance of that. I think helping individuals understand how other successful persons have learned to cope with those social issues is really a key experience. I appreciate Wendy's question in particular as well to what Guga's mentioned, because I think, as Malcolm Ballantyne has said, we have gone to where the initial career choice is really the exception to the rule. What we really have is, over a period of time, a lifetime of choices that we're making. And therefore, career management is really what we need to focus on preparing people to do. In the past, our guidance, especially the way I was trained, all the emphasis was on the first choice. And once a person made the first choice, either they stayed in that all their life, or they essentially could sort that through on their own. But now we know the complexity of the job market, the complexity of individuals' lives, the rapid change in our society, that we really need to have more effort towards career management. And part of career management, I think, is if we look at the variables that we've been talking about, readiness, is helping people understand that readiness is not a static concept. It's a dynamic concept. So family variables change over time. So a person, as a young person, could have excellent family support, but as an adult who's now experiencing a divorce and caring for children, now there's a complexity in their life that didn't exist when that initial choice occurred when they were 20. So we have to, I think, if we're looking from a career management perspective, it's helping people understand that there are certain kind of life experiences that people have. Donald Super talked about, you know, the life cycle and the various typical things that happen to people over time. But we know those are really varied among people. It's to make sure that individuals are capable of understanding that a change in my life circumstance may make it appropriate for me to get more help now than I needed when I was a young person. On the other hand, in terms of career management, as we help people to gain a greater sense of their own career self-efficacy through transferable skills analysis and portfolio development, older adults have much more to work from in making a career choice. But these readiness variables we're talking about still influence their ability to make sense of their work experience. Because when you have that chronic depression, chronic anxiety, that can have you could easily misinterpret these work experiences that you've had in a negative way. Just as a person can misinterpret school experiences as an adolescent, that restricts their career choice as an adult. So I think from a career management perspective, these readiness variables are equally important.
So you partly answered the next questions which I have from Rosti Vasilieva from Sofia, Bulgaria, because she's asking whether these variables are different concerning adult and group of young people, or as youngs as a group. And then we have another question from Spain, Rebecca García Muriath. She's asking whether these whether the labor mobility facilitate the choice on work precision.
Let me just make a comment on the first question real quick. And that has to deal with, I think there are some unique issues of being an adult in the workforce. I think of Jeff Ford's work on third age guidance. There are some unique issues as an adult moves into the third age of their life, and they begin coping with the issues that one faces at that time. Certainly things that my wife and I are thinking about currently as we envision our future. There are some unique things, and I think if we probably could tease apart the model for young people, for working adults in career management, and people in third age. And there probably are some differing levels of impact of some of the variables. I think that's probably true, but we're going to have to work on this to better understand that. And the other question dealt with...
Whether does the labor mobility facilitate the choice on work precision?
The whole mobility question is... there are pluses and minuses, I think, to the mobility question. The mobility question means that people have opportunities they would not have had otherwise. So really encourage mobility. But as one becomes mobile, there are unique issues that they have to deal with. For example, the language issue that we mentioned as readiness becomes really important there. Utilizing local information, contextual information about local employment when I've moved from a rural part of a country to an urban part of a country. There are more options available. Mobility across borders, where then I'm dealing with language issues. And all these wonderful resources are available to me, but I'm having difficulty using those resources because I'm in a different culture, because I'm using a different language. Then I think probably we need more support for individuals who have been recently mobile. I know that in our work in Scotland and in Northern Ireland and England, one of the things that we found is that the percentage of the clients who needed more intensive help varied by mobility. We had larger numbers of immigrants. I remember in one town in Northern Ireland where we had a fairly significant a group of Polish immigrants come into that particular area, into that labor market. One of the things that we did was to prepare some of the information in Polish to be able to facilitate the mobility of workers into that community. But then also some sensitivity on the staff's part about the cultural issues and differences became really important. So. I think as we look at some of these specific issues, we find that some of the variables are more affected than others. And I think mobility would be clearly an example.
Okay, thank you. I think we move on to the next second part of the presentation. And if you have further comments, please don't hesitate to ask. And also for our international audience, the chat and the tweet is open. And tweet is hashtag CIPJKL. Go ahead.
It's important to take a look at what happens to individuals if we don't intervene effectively. What are the negative consequences that can happen as a result of a person with low readiness for career decision making coming to us and not getting the help that they need? And there are these seven variables that we have here. Premature disengagement, negative perception of skills, negative perception of interests, selective acquisition of incomplete information, premature choice foreclosure, protracted exploration, dependent decision-making style, and poor evaluation of options are all negative consequences of poor readiness for using a career intervention, poor readiness for decision-making. The first is premature disengagement. And clients may prematurely disengage their use of a career resource and service due to a perception that difficulty in using career resources suggests a failure to be helped. People who are depressed, people who are anxious, people who are thinking very negatively about themselves and their opportunities, if the first experience they have being helped isn't successful, sometimes because we didn't provide them with adequate support when they needed it, because we didn't know they needed it, we didn't take the time to ask, we give them a resource, they use the resource, and they think, well, that nice man gave this to me, and I'm supposed to be able to use and understand this. I have no idea what this means and how I use this information. I don't belong here. I'm not going to be able to be helped here. Some people can be helped here, and then some people can't. I'm one of the ones that can't benefit from being here. And typically what they say is, excuse me, you know, which way is the men's room? Oh, it's down the hall there. And they get up from their chair, and they're out the front door. And they don't come back. That wasn't their failure, it was ours. Because we put them in a situation where they weren't really capable of succeeding, because we didn't really check carefully to see if they were ready for what it was that we were giving them. Another example is clients may discontinue use of a computer-assisted career guidance system when the initial listing of occupations doesn't include current occupational aspirations. This is a common problem. You look at the list, well, what I was thinking of wasn't on there. This is a waste of my time. Well, there's a reason why it wasn't on there. It's because you said that you wouldn't accept the level of educational attainment that's required in the position. That's why it's not on the list. If you want to have that kind of occupation, it takes more schooling. And they fail to understand that dynamic. They don't see it on the list, and they say, this is a waste of my time. It didn't show what I wanted it to show. I'm leaving. Another one is negative perception of skills. Clients may develop a negative perception of their skills due to their anticipated failure in completing work tasks that would lead to disappointment and embarrassment. An example of this would be someone is thinking about, oh, public speaking, yes, that would be nice to be up in front of people and have their respect and I could talk about interesting things. And then the negative thinking kicks in and think, but boy, you know, what if I forgot what I was saying? What if I was up in front of all these people and I couldn't remember what I was supposed to talk about? Everybody would be staring at me. That would be embarrassing. I would fail. No, I don't want that. I don't want to do that. In reality, they had an interest in doing it. But their anticipated failure caused them to say, no, I don't think I want to do that because I don't want to fail. They had an aspiration, they found something interested, and then it's reduced because of that negative thinking about themselves in what they were doing. Another example, clients may underestimate their skills in an assessment, resulting in an unnecessarily restricted list of potentially appropriate occupations that don't really reflect their potential for success. They essentially use some of these search mechanisms and these guidance interventions in a very limited way, and therefore they get back what they put in the system, in the search criteria, which is a very limited set of options. We want to help them increase their aspirations in that particular sense. Negative perception of interest. Clients may develop a negative perception of their interests after they imagine failure in applying skills associated with an interest. This is actually, when I told you about the person in public speaking, that is the example on this slide. I always like to make a mistake in a presentation. Kind of makes you kind of relax and, okay, I'm human, you know. So anyway, that's the example for this particular point, which is you have an interest, but then you imagine failure in it. Clients may initially, see how good I was? Clients may initially like public speaking and then imagine failure in front of others due to a lack of skill, which results in reduced interest in speaking publicly. I was so excited about that example I gave. It's called premature exampling is the concept there. Another one is selective acquisition of incomplete information. Clients may selectively acquire incomplete information which reinforces a pre-existing conclusion they would not be interested in or succeed in an occupation or education training program. And here's how that happens. The client selectively reviews occupational information topics that focus on difficult aspects of work in an occupation and then decide not to pursue learning about the opportunities in that field. It's when we have an answer and we go searching for information that supports our answer. We essentially use guidance information as a way to affirm a negative decision that we've already made. Well, I'm never going to succeed at fill in the blank. And then you look at that occupational information and to say, yep, see, these are the really hard bits. I'd never be able to do that. Because your negative thinking, therefore, influences your aspirations in this case. Premature choice foreclosure. Clients prematurely foreclose occupational education training or employment choices to avoid the risk or effort involved in exploring other potentially appropriate options. Clients may prematurely discontinue use of a search for options feature of a computer-assisted career guidance system after one search in order to confirm a choice that poses little risk of failure, even though clients have only minimal interest in that option. People can manipulate their guidance experience. They're so afraid, they're afraid of failure, they think there's one option, they manipulate their experience, and so they find the answer that they've already come to in this process. And if we don't have some human input in here, essentially the message here is that if we don't assess readiness, and if we don't know that a person is poorly prepared for this career intervention, if we have assessed for readiness, we know they're more at risk, then we say this person is going to need more human assistance, more assistance from a practitioner to go through this. But if the person is very well prepared, high readiness for decision making, then we can more confidently say you can really use this on the internet on your own, and that greatly increases individuals' access to the guidance that they need because of the fact that we have it available on the internet. And this is something Tristram Hooley has really, I think, been very eloquent about. Protracted exploration. Lower readiness for career decision making might also be affected by a compulsive need for a perfect option. We had one gentleman in our career center, and he came in every day for weeks. And we finally had to sit down with him and say that just looking at more information is not going to help you. But he was trying for perfection. He was trying for this one perfect answer that would help him get his life back on track. And he knew he needed to do something, and so he was just spinning his wheels as a result of that. Clients may engage in protracted exploration of occupational education, training, employment choices to avoid a risk of failure. He kept on saying, I've got to get more information before I start going on job interviews. Well, he was never going to go on a job interview because he was using that looking for information as a way to avoid putting himself at risk. Dependent decision-making style. Clients may adopt a dependent decision-making style to avoid taking responsibility for a career decision that is favored or not favored by a significant other. In other words, I'll just do what whoever, fill in the blank, tells me because I don't want to have a conflict with them. Even though I don't really want to do what they suggest, I feel like I have to do that. Again, that's some of that dysfunctional family input that we mentioned earlier. Poor evaluation of options is the last point. Clients may engage in a poor evaluation of options where the benefits are underestimated and the limitations are overestimated in a way that reinforces a pre-existing conclusion that an occupation or educational training option is inappropriate. Again, this is where I've made my I have the answer. I'm going to find information that fits the conclusion that I have. Unfortunately, what this means is that people end up in occupations where they really could have done other things. They had the capabilities, but their low readiness and their negative thinking about themselves caused them to reduce their aspirations. This has been something we talked about, the NEET group, the Not in Education Training group. because of their negative expectations about their options and what they're going to be do actually lowers their aspirations, which is a real problem. To conclude this part, we look at the negative consequences of all of these variables that we've been looking at. There are really two ultimate consequences. One is making a poor choice when an absolute time limit is reached, often selecting by default the only option that remains. You just procrastinate, and then options are eliminated, and then you're simply left with one particular option. I refer to it as backing into a career choice, like this. In other words, I keep on procrastinating until there's only one option available to me, as opposed to moving towards a career choice in an intentional way, which is much, much more appropriate. And the second one is failing to select a good occupational education, training, or employment option when one was available. Now, we can debate what is good, what's a good choice, but still, this is where a person fails to select an option that would have given them opportunities, stability of employment, more of a high-wage job that they could have had if they had been more positive about thinking about themselves and had engaged the process and made a more careful and informed choice with that. So let's talk in the, I want to just really briefly mention some implications, and then we're going to have a chance for a few more questions. The first and most important implication for practice is that persons with moderate to low readiness for the use of career resources, they need brief staff-assisted or individual case-managed counseling interventions. In our model, our CIP approach, we have three levels of assistance: self-help, brief staff-assisted, and individual case-managed. The individualized approach is the most intensive. The brief is very cost-effective. But some people need assistance. And people with low readiness are not going to be able to benefit from these career interventions unless they have some form of practitioner assistance. But not everybody needs assistance. If we have that kind of guidance model where we believe that everyone should come in and everyone should talk to someone, that's going to restrict the number of people who can get help. That's a social justice issue. And it's actually that paper on social justice is referenced at the end of your handout. If we assume that everybody needs to have a counselor, there's not enough counselors to meet the needs of everyone. We need to be able to use the web, the internet, wisely to allow people to engage in these self-help resources. There's a whole lot of issues about how to create these web resources so that they, as Marcus Offer said, funnel people back to guidance resources when it's appropriate. So there are issues about how to design the resources appropriately. Another thing that Tristram Hooley and Tony Watts have talked a lot about over the years, as well as Marcus Offer. But we need to make sure that we have guidance resources available to everyone in our society. And self-help is an important part of doing that. But without some attention to the readiness of the individual, we end up putting individuals in failure circumstances because they use self-help resources when they didn't have a level of readiness to be able to effectively use those. Some people need assistance in making career choices. Our job is to use readiness assessment to identify in a proactive way at the beginning who needs that kind of help. Or at least as they engage in the use of these career resources on the internet, there are ways to funnel them back into human intervention when it is clear that that's what is really required. We have a four-step counseling model in a book that Deb Ebner and Margaret Dykel and myself have written, but I think is referenced in your handout. But it's on using the web and counseling and the internet. But there's a four-step counseling model, which essentially is screening, recommending, orienting, and follow-up. and we have specific counselor behaviors for each of those. If we're going to really work with someone at a distance, those are the four things to do to help someone make effective use of a career intervention. In the screening part, that's where the readiness assessment takes place, in that screening part. In the recommending part, there's selecting, sequencing, and pacing are three important things in making a recommendation. Selecting what resource to use, in what order, and how fast can they successfully use those resources and take it all in. Orienting them to those resources and then following up to make sure that it worked. Now, there is an issue about readiness. Is the glass half empty or half full? I realize that I've been talking pretty negatively. And there is a trend in our profession right now, emphasis on positive psychology. We need to take a look at individual strengths. We shouldn't be focusing on the negative with this. But I think there is a need to really take a look at some of the negative with this. They need to look at the characteristics of the client, the circumstances in which they live, or both, because these can contribute to problems in the decisions that they make. While there's value in stressing the positive and focusing on strengths with clients, I am not against that. I think that's a very good thing to do. But there are circumstances where we do have to look at the problems people bring with them. I think if we fail to address these barriers, internal and external, we're not doing as good a job as possible. It's important for practitioners to help clients understand how their characteristics or circumstances may negatively impact their ability to make an informed choice. So I'm arguing for balance here. Both the positive and the negative approach, I think, are both parts of the human experience that really need to be addressed. I think we need some additional research on issues of, related to multicultural and diversity factors that influence all the different readiness variables that we've looked at, because I think they do have an influence. We need to better understand and tease those out. On your handout, there is additional references from some of the people that I've been talking about. In the paper themselves, it includes some additional reading for you to take a look at that will show you the support for the contentions that I've been making. So I think we have some time for some additional questions.
Any brief reflections, or should we have again 2 minutes with your neighbor and then we pick up some immediate reflections? Also for the international community, you're welcome to present comments. It seems we will go beyond our time a couple of minutes, but it's okay. We are getting some comments from the international audience, but we can start from our live audience. We have one question over there. Takari, if you pass the microphone, please. I think we can have some 5-10 minutes extra time if you allow us.
Thank you for your presentation. I'm Ritva Partanen, and I'm studying to be a counselor. And this last slide, you were talking about the conceptualizing readiness. Is the glass half full or empty? It's a question that I've been thinking a lot, and I would like to hear from you, how do you go around about with a person who thinks that the glass is half empty? How do you make her or him to believe that it's half full? Or can you do that?
I really believe you can help a person move from thinking the glass is half empty to the glass is half full. I think it's first by acknowledging the validity of that person's feelings at that moment and to accept them for having those feelings of negativity. So we start off from a position of acceptance that it's okay to feel that way. Yeah. Second, they have to understand, however, that in feeling that way, there are certain consequences. You know, as you expect things to fail, things tend to fail. In other words, the power of the mind to influence our behavior is amazing. And as we have these expectations that things are not going to work out, and then they become a self-fulfilling prophecy. But one of the ways that I've been able to reach young people in this regard is through sports. And if you will think back to the Olympics, the most recent Olympics in London, we had some of our faculty there attending that and working at the Olympics. There were a large number of sports psychologists there. On all of our major professional sports teams, we now have sports psychologists working on them. And they're talking about performance enhancement. And this kind of work is extending on to many high-stakes performance-related fields, like surgeons, for example. When there's a performance, you must succeed at this task. It's like the person in American football that's kicking the field goal. We know, we have lots of evidence, that when they imagine kicking the ball through the uprights and they can see themselves through the entire process and they can visualize success, that they are more successful. When you visualize missing, you have a much greater chance of missing. So I've used that sport and analogy with clients to be able to say that what you expect to happen, what you imagine to happen, will guide your behavior. And so I'll acknowledge them, accept them for having these negative feelings, say there are consequences to these negative feelings, step number two. Step number three then is some reframing, helping them to understand that the way that they think, they can change the way they think. I'll help them identify absolute thinking in the language that they use, when they use all, never, must, always, can't. When people use those kind of words, that's the glass is half empty. And I train them to begin to monitor their language, what they think and what they say, to avoid those kind of words and reframe it into a positive. So instead of saying, I can't, I'm not going to be able to do this, instead saying, this is going to be hard, I've never done this before, but if someone will show me how to do it and someone will help me if I begin to fail, if I know somebody's there to help me, I think I can do this. If I can help them make that change and then support them as they go through that, then I think I can help them see the glass as half full. And this distinction between the glass half full and empty is an important one, because what it helps us to understand is really all we have is the glass. And you know, we could say you either have what you need in the glass or you don't have what you need in the glass. So I can either focus on what's there and therefore what's missing, or I can focus on what's missing and what needs to be added. You know, what we need to do is to focus on what clients bring to us, what they have, what they need to make these effective decisions. Good question.
Thank you.
Raimo?
Yeah, we have a question from Wendy Hurst that what you have been presenting here, what are the implications for career education as opposed to guidance in schools and colleges and the workplace of readiness factors, and whether there are any typically under-addressed in programs for career education?
Good question, Wendy. The part that's under-addressed in careers education has been this assessment of readiness. Typically hasn't been done. There's been an assumption in career education that all children come to, or adolescents, come to a prearranged curriculum, and my career education curriculum is going to therefore include this predetermined sequence of events. Well, that predetermined sequence of events in career education depends if the person is ready for that particular sequence. So there is some need in career education for some ability for differentiated services. That would include, for the students that need some additional help, how are they going to get some additional time talking with someone beyond the general material available in the classroom guidance activity. There's also, I think, in addition to providing supplemental help, it's possible in the career education program to acknowledge how these various readiness factors influence a person's the choices they make. We did have some work in England when we were working in Coventry. We tried to address this, and there was a readiness measure that was given by grade level, by year level in school, so that we could then get a readiness picture of an entire grade level of students in terms of their readiness for decision making. And then as a result of that, we could tailor the year-level intervention to emphasize certain topics. We ran into an issue, though. What happens when you had a student who scored, in a way, on the readiness measure that indicated they were strongly in need of help, you know, that there may be some other issues involved? Perhaps there is some abuse at home. Perhaps there is some problem with substance abuse. What do you do? Do you identify that student as being the problem student? So there's some guidance issues about in schools of, once you identify a student at risk, how do you get them assistance without labeling them as the problem child? So that was a difficult, but that was hard to really think that through.
And we have one question from the audience, and then one question and a comment from the chat room. So.
Okay, thank you. My name is Riikka-Maria Autio, and I'm working in upper secondary school for adults in Turku. And I'm counseling immigrants, and most of them are refugees. And I'm always facing the same problems, that I do know that they have, of course, some language problems. They come from a different culture. So there are lots of things I can see, lots of things which are visible. But I always face the same problems with timetables or just these difficulties of decision-making. And I think that there has to be a story, something which is completely invisible for me, something which I can't not see. So do you have any tools for to approach this problem? How can we see the inner story of a person?
Yes, in fact, I do have an answer for that. And let me recommend what I think is one of the most important pieces of writing on ICT and guidance that I've read in the past 10 years. And it's a publication called Careering Through the Web by Hooley, Hutchinson, and Watts. And in that paper, they talk about kind of the guidance of the future and how we need to change guidance to better address the needs that individuals have. And one of the things that they talk about in that monograph is that we need to move from a model where it's all our responsibility as the experts to create the resources. And instead, we need to move to what I refer to as a blended model, where the experts have provided information, but we also get the voices of the people being served. And this is what Jana has mentioned in terms of some of the social media elements of getting the voice of the individuals as well as the voice of the professionals. So in this case, in your case, it's how have the immigrants who have made a success of the transition, how have they coped? What has worked for them? What's not worked for them? I think we need to trust, in one sense, the people we're helping, that they have some ideas themselves of how to approach things. If all the responsibility for guidance is on our shoulders, it's hard to do a really good job. But instead, if we begin to share that responsibility with the people who are getting help and begin to capture these stories, which is where I think some of the value of the narrative approach is now, what are the stories of people in your community who you've helped who have really succeeded? And what's made the difference for them in their life? Let's bring their voice into the conversation as well. I think that's where I think guidance needs to move in the future.
And we get a comment from Gudbjörg from Iceland that she mentioned that both the educational institutions, employers and counselors have joined their forces in activating young people in schools and in work to examine their readiness for these purposes. But we can one short question from Bulgaria, whether you have been working with employers and managers to make them aware of these variables, what you have been describing so far.
Most of the, especially in the United States, most of the work recently with employers has really been not so much through human HRD work, but have been more through career coaches who have been working to empower workers to be able to negotiate their employment in a more effective and successful way. I don't think there has been as much of a conversation about how to help workers related to the readiness variables. But this is a really interesting question, because if we look at worker productivity, which is what employers are obviously interested in, I'd be willing to bet you if we examine productivity of workers in relationship to the readiness variables, we'd find that the workers that are thinking negatively, under a lot of stress, ones that aren't really good users of information resources, who aren't making informed decisions, are not the most productive employees. So it'd be interesting if we could sell to employers the idea that if we can make people more effective individuals, they're more effective employees. And being a more effective individual means dealing with the readiness variables that we've really been talking about.
Thank you. And I think, one more brief question before closing up.
Hi, I'm Elena Kemi. I'm studying to be a student counselor. Could you give a practical tip to us all? How do you use screening in practice? Do you ask questions? Do you have a questionnaire? How do you do it?
That's an excellent question. We do it in two steps. The first step is what we call brief screening, and we will ask someone when they come to us for assistance, and in our case, we have a career resource center where they actually come walk in the front door to be assisted. And we'll say, what brings you here today? If they have a concrete request for information and there's no evidence they have a problem, we refer them to information resources or assessment resources. But we go back and we check with them to make sure that they're getting what they need. That's the safety net that's crucial to make the model work. If they're experiencing difficulty, I'll stop and I'll ask them, are you finding the information you need? And if they in any way indicate that they're struggling and their information's not helpful, then I'll sit down and I'll do step two of the assessment. And in step two of the assessment, we use a readiness screening measure. And Jukka Lurkinen here, that I mentioned earlier, has developed this measure in Finnish for the population that you're going to be working with. At that point in time, then I think that readiness measure would be helpful, because then that will more clearly identify what he's found in his research. There are three three major kind of areas: decision-making confusion, commitment anxiety, and external conflict, that help to pinpoint where the readiness issue exists. But what you could do in a school setting that would be helpful, that he's done in his research, is to administer the readiness assessment to the entire grade level. Therefore, the staff can get an idea of what's the nature of this year's group of students and how ready are they. So if you find out that it's really a question of commitment anxiety, in other words, they have enough information, they know what they want to do, but they're finding difficulty in actually making the choice, you can then design an intervention that focuses more on specific decision-making strategies versus decision-making confusion, where I don't really understand how to make the decision. So you could use that assessment diagnostically determine which guidance interventions are most appropriate for that year level. And if you could just mention the name of the measure.
First of all, thank you for outstanding lecture, Jim. It was a pleasure once again to listen to you. So my name is Jukka Lerkkanen, and I'm coming from Jyväskylä University of Applied Sciences from the Teacher Education College there. And I have developed these readiness measures for the Finnish population, and the Finnish version is found. And it's the free access in internet, and this address will become in Finnish now, www.ohjaustarvearvio, kaikki pienillä kirjaimilla yhteen kirjoitettuna, ohjaustarvearvio.fi. Siellä on kaksi versiota olemassa. Toinen versio on ammattikorkeakoululaisille, ja melkeinpä suosittelisin, että tutustuisitte tähän pilottiversioon. Nämä ovat pilottiversioita. Toinen versio on perusopetukseen, ja sitä on testattu tänä keväänä Jyväskylän kaupungin perusopetuksessa.
Thank you.
And one thing more, we will meet in April. I will lecturing to you, and then you will get more exact information about the results.
Thank you, Jukka. This is an example of the cooperation which we have had during the last years with Florida State University. But I use this opportunity to conclude the session, and I think what we have heard about the variables affecting the readiness, they are very, very crucial when we are thinking of the current paradigm shift in guidance. We are facing the cuts of public resources that are allocated to services, so it's crucial that we also take into account this user-centered approach in guidance, because many adults and many people, citizens, are using the services with or without the practitioners. So it's like Jim says, it's an issue of social equity that we are promoting the individual care management skills, but maintain guidance as a social contract, like a safety net for the citizens. And like Gudbjörg from Iceland mentioned, it's a joint effort between different stakeholders in education, employment and social settings. And this is a common issue and a common trend within the European Union member states, what we have been working during the last years. So it's a joint effort, and that's why this issue and this presentation was delivered to the members of the European Lifelong Guidance Policy Network in 32 countries. So we want to share some of these background themes. So once more, thanks to Jim, and thanks for you for comments, and also the international audience, and we look forward for future cooperation. The materials will be available on our website at the Center for National Lifelong Guidance Expertise in Finland, evokes.fi, but also if you go to FSU website, there are a lot of very valuable resources over there. So once more, thank you, and I wish you success in your future studies, and hope we can be in cooperation in the future as well. Thanks, Tim.